Vision Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. Today is January 12th, 2017. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for following our show. Please do share us. We're trying to expand our listenership. Today we have on a returning guest. His name is Crow. He's a shaman. His real name is John McKinnon. John, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate you being here with us.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you again, Lonnie.
Yay, it actually worked. Thank you. I think I fixed the problem with the phone call. So yay, we've made progress here. John, why don't you give people the name of your website so I don't get it incorrectly?
Certainly. It's shamanicvoyages.com. And that takes you to our main page. And there's several links showing you where we go and what we do and what we believe in and so forth.
Okay. Well, we had you on for the first time a few weeks ago, and we had a pretty interesting discussion about what this journey means about really, I guess the journey is into our spiritual life, which is really essentially our real life, right? Like, that's essentially what we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah. Shamanism is one of the oldest forms of spiritual practice known to man. And the resurgence here in the West is not only rediscovering that, but also kind of democratizing spirituality, if you will, taking it back to make it an individual practice of revelation and connection and working with others. And our group, our main focus is to try to connect shamanic communities globally by taking visitors, shamanic practitioners from the United States and other Western countries to other countries where there's a long history of shamanism that's still being practiced or recently rediscovered as well. And so it's kind of a diplomatic cultural exchange kind of thing from the spiritual perspective, if you will.
You know, I have to say, whenever you say the word shamanic, even after our last conversation, I still have this image of a bone through the nose and somebody holding up rattles, right? So there's a lot of ingrained ideas about what that means. Why don't you remind our listeners what that truly means? It's not like some primitive riding on caves hoping that somebody's going to come and help us. Why don't we talk about what that really means?
Well, every culture is going to have its own expression. What the Foundation for Shamanic Studies does, which is an organization I belong to that's centered here in the United States, they try to focus on the core aspects of shamanism that are kind of universally shared among shamanic cultures, and in that way, kind of get to the real nut of what shamanism is without the without the bones through the nose and all the other decoration that various cultures mix with it. Here in the U.S., we like to think that we're the great melting pot and everything, but the United States has kind of developed its own persona, if you will, as being the rational, scientifically based, thinking, kind of empirical. And that's kind of the flavor that that shamanism has here in the U.S. Kind of trying to understand why beating a drum helps you to reach a shamanic state of consciousness or trance, if you will. There's a lot of collection of information about what people experience when they practice shamanism here in the West, and it doesn't really take away from what works about shamanism, but it kind of makes it easier for people who have a Western outlook to understand and relate to. I don't know if that addresses your question or not, but
it makes me think that, maybe that whole idea of empirical scientific knowledge, maybe that won't be such a big deal since we're about to enter the Trump nation. So I don't think, empirical knowledge, actually, I don't think knowledge in itself is going to be very well respected. So, but let me ask you this, because this is a question I didn't ask you the last time. Can a person be, follow a religion and still be, can you be a Catholic or a Jew and still be a shaman? Do those things intertwine?
Absolutely. Shamanism is not necessarily religion. It's certainly not from the core shamanic view. I know a lot of people who, are very spiritually active in an established church that also are shamanic practitioners. Some of the visual or the visionary experiences people have include religious dogma that they're either understand and support, or something that they're familiar with, and it surprises them that they have these experiences. It's not excluding anyone, it's more about taking the practice home to yourself and trying to experience direct revelation. Now, a Catholic from a long, long time ago would take their orders from Rome only, and Rome might say, no, they did a pretty good job, stamping out shamanism throughout most of Europe. But I think that the Catholic Church and a lot of other churches are becoming more progressive as far as trying to focus on spirituality rather than political control. Not that it isn't still happening. It certainly is. But I think that, most people who are seeking in a way that is a little more open than it used to be. I don't know if that's answering your question, really. But
well, your response prompts this question then. So shamanism itself doesn't lend itself to any type of organized political movement, like where a group will, say, organize among shamanic practices and say, we've got to put pressure on the government to allow this or allow that. It sounds like it's much more of an individual, it's kind of like a tentacle with an octopus, right? It has all these tentacles out there and they're all independent of each other.
True. The octopus has one brain. And if shamans are going to look for any image that resembles that, we would prefer to call that something like the collective consciousness, if you will. Shamanism in some cultures has, perhaps a little more political influence than it does here, but people who tend to commit themselves to a spiritual, a very open spiritual mindset, do tend to gravitate toward others in fighting what they think are, important issues, fighting for important issues. For instance, in Mongolia, for instance, there's a large mountain called Noyan Mountain, which is a familiar issue if you're at all involved with Mongolians. It's a very spiritual place. It's an icon, really, and there are very ancient tombs that are there, and there's a lot of spiritual and cultural significance to Noyan Mountain. But it has been coming to the attention of mining companies and so forth, and you know, they basically want to strip mine the mountain. So in that case, the shamans from Mongolia have been seeking the support of other shamans globally to support them, you know, not just morally, but also actively in their spiritual prayers, if you will, or journeying, or, you know, whatever it is that we do. it's difficult to describe, you know, to the common layperson, the sort of works that we do, aside from seeing clients. Everybody can understand that, but there's a type of shamanic work called psychopomp, which is the, I guess, a Greek translation for guiding souls. And this is work that you do that, you know, you don't get compensated for it, but it's kind of like really investing your heart into seeking the assistance of whatever compassionate spirits might be out there to relieve a disharmony in the world or in an individual. If that is making sense to you, that they can kind of describe a lot of what shamans do that people aren't generally aware of. You know, even in small cultures where shamanism is very accepted and so forth, you know, they get the give and take, the solution to a problem. You know, there's a cause and effect relationship with how they engage with shamanism, but they also trust their shamans to be caring for the group as a whole, and helping to protect the society or in the very earth that we live on. And there are a lot of us that really feel that is part of what we need to do as representatives of this particular, you know, spiritual art, if you will. So that gives you, you know, to bring it full circle, that gives you kind of an example of how shamans might come together for a political cause.
Well, look, as you were speaking, this question came up in my mind about the sounds that when you were saying that the drum beats, that like drumming actually helps you. I've actually had ring therapy where this lady, I sat on a chair and she just did these rings and brought I don't know how she did it, but they were like these glass bowls and metal bowls, like copper bowls or something like that. And she would circle them around and they made this super high pitched thing. And it actually really did help. I don't know. I mean, it was really odd. It was like one of the weirdest kind of alternative treatments I've had. But it sounds very similar to like the shamanic chants of what you know, how we bring ourselves into wholeness through the shamanic chants. So all of that made me just wonder, like, our language. I know one of the things that I was fascinated about when I first began to become fluent in Spanish is how my thoughts changed. Actual ability to speak the language, and English is such a harsh language and inaccurate and vague, and you have to really search for accuracy in English, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
It occurred to me, I wonder if the way we speak our languages and like even the names that we call ourselves, like how we vocalize ourselves, has anything to do with how we reflect our spirituality at a cultural level. I mean, I think that's one of the issues within, frankly, the Anglo-American, the whole concept of those of us whose base is English, is we have lost out on a whole level of spirituality, a whole level of harmony. Like Spanish to me was like speaking constantly speaking a song, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I found it pretty easily. You know what I mean? So I wonder if that concept of how we, when you were talking about the Tibetans and their language, do you think that the way we vocalize and speak our language connects us in a deeper level to who we are as true human beings?
Oh, I absolutely do. You know, the influence of the way we speak and the way we you know, visualize our thoughts, you know, in different languages. You know, I could almost see it in my head when you were talking about it. You know, I kind of attribute color almost to the difference between speaking Spanish and speaking English. You know, because it's a less precise language, there are intonations that also kind of convey meaning, or you think of a lot of the tonal languages in Asia where it can be the exact same word, but there's a tone variation which completely changes the impact of the meaning. So, you know, and also, I don't know if you know any deaf people or people who are close to them. Their worldview is very different if they've never had hearing. It's very different from speaking people because they have a much more visual world. They're so much more attuned to visual input. They don't have this, you know, they don't have language to convey thinking, you know, at least not verbal language or sound. It's conveyed rather through, visual cues and so forth. There was a group that did a fabulous presentation here on the East Coast that was covered by the Public Broadcasting Company of a lot of deaf students that were encouraged to write poetry. Now, they know what language is. They know what poetry is. They can read. But to compose their own poetry and share it by signing, it was such a phenomenally powerful thing to watch because not only the way that they conceptualized thoughts through physical action, but to watch them, it was almost like dancing, but it was communicating very clearly, not that clearly to me. I didn't understand all the signing or anything, but you could tell that there was an incredible expression going on. And to think that at a very fundamental level, this person thinks and communicates so much more, you know, so much differently than we do. It's almost like it's more than just a cultural difference. It's almost like I don't know how to describe it.
But, yeah, well, it's kind of like a person who's vision impaired. They see the world very differently. Like I know myself, mm-hmm. like my vision is pretty severely impaired, right? So I have a different sense. Like I can feel things, and I don't mm-hmm. know how that is, but I just know things. I feel things, and my vision is pretty severely impaired, frankly. Like last night I did a video, I was doing a reading and I didn't wear my glasses, and at the end I was talking to my audience and my eyes were, after I looked at it, my eyes were like wildly wrangling all over the place. I thought I was looking right directly into the camera, right? It's totally hilarious, but it makes you realize like the things that we're not even conscious of and how deeply we rely on those alternative senses without even, and the misconception that we can, this is kind of where we're hit. Like part of, I think, from our last conversation to how I sort of ingested what you said to us the last time, is that part of it is how we, the conversations we say to ourselves and what we absorb into ourselves sort of help us guide our way from the misconceptions of how we perceive the world, and that's part of the shamanic journey.
And being open to that variety of experience too. You know, as we were talking earlier about some of the real challenges that we face in our world right now with a, well, you know, is there another way to say it? What many of us conceive to be a very narrow-minded and dangerous administration. People like that, I don't think entertain that the world is any other way than what they can understand, and they won't even be open to it. And that is one of the things that is really important, that we, you know, recognize the shortcomings in that philosophy and really strive to live in a larger world and recognize that you know, there is no there is no real right or wrong. There are many perspectives. I don't know. I'm going off on a tangent. Whenever I think about the political administration, my brain wants to seize up.
But, well, this is the thing. Like, what we're having to do is figure out how to navigate our way through this, because you're right, it is narrow-minded, it is dangerous, and really, they really do look at us like, you liberals, you guys are you're the reason that all this has gone awry. And really, they're setting out, like this week, they have set out to really undermine the safety nets, because people have forgotten the rickets, the childhood starvation, the adult starvation. You know, old people, literally, when Romney said people could sell pencils on the street corner, he wasn't joking. People used to do that, right? We
True.
used to have little blind girls selling flowers on the corner very commonly, to the point where Charlie Chaplin made a movie about it, right? One
Sure.
of his heroines was about a young girl, 14, 15 years old, out selling flowers, and that people were desperate. And so part of what the New Deal gave us was a safety net, right? Funded by everyone. And so, but how we manage ourselves through this next challenging time really has to do with our internal spiritual language, because it's not going to do anyone any good to get involved in the hate machine. This is why I really refrain from, I really cannot tolerate name calling, all of these. I mean, you know, to call each other on either side of the aisle, it's just complete. Now, I do kind of draw the line, because I do call them fascists. That's not actually name calling, because that's actually a like this morning, Donald Trump's tweet was to support L.L. Bean. Well, here it comes, you know, like the true fascism, like government supporting private corporations. I mean, what do you think Rex Tillerson is all about? I mean, you know, ExxonMobil has huge vested interest in normalizing relations with Russia. Now, I'm not against that. But it's kind of like, where are our values? And I think it's this kind of dichotomy, I think, that maybe this journey into shamanism, this is why I like the idea that we can still maintain our religious beliefs and still take a journey into that, opening our minds to a different way of perceiving our spirituality.
Yes, absolutely. And the only thing that a person needs to really clear with themselves ahead of time is that do they believe that the religion that they believe in permits them to have direct experience of spiritual matters? Because that's the only place you're going to have a conflict between religion and spiritual and I'm sorry, and shamanism. Shamanism says nothing about other religions and their validity or invalidity. It only talks about this direct experience and interaction that you have with the spiritual realms. It's like, for instance, there are organizations, fraternal organizations, that have existed for a really long time that have been open to everybody, but there are people whose religions prevented them from joining. And it's kind of like that. You have to clear with yourself. Am I okay with experiencing for myself and not trusting that the hierarchy is going to tell me what I can't experience, you know? And I'm all for, complete support in your statement about hate. Hate is something that we feel. It's a feeling akin to fear. It's being afraid and trying to feel powerful at the same time. That's what makes hate. And it's natural sometimes to experience that, but it is it is only productive if you after that experience you try to turn it into something more useful. Like if you hit yourself in the thumb with a hammer, you're going to experience pain. And then the next thing that you should do is, okay, how do I alleviate the suffering here? You try to do something useful to resolve that conflict that you have, the pain. People can't be held accountable really for being angry or for being fearful and so forth, but they can be held accountable for staying there, because that is not productive. It's important to get angry at, for instance, the main kernel of your program is about Fukushima and the terrible
history,
the terrible travesty that we're suffering through because of people's greed and refusal to take responsibility for making bad decisions. It's important to get angry about that, because the anger motivates you to move in a direction toward resolution. At least that's the only thing that's going to help anybody. You know, being angry and stomping your feet and yelling, once you get through that, It serves a little purpose to continue doing that, unless it is drawing people toward a resolution of some kind. And specifically on Fukushima, I know this is a total segue from what we're talking about, but I did want to ask you, are you familiar with Ken Buesler?
Oh, yes.
Woodtall?
Yes. I do not have any respect for the guy, as a matter of fact.
I think he's
part of the problem. Yeah, I think he is part of the big problem. I think he's paid big money to pretend he is telling us the truth, when in fact he's subverting the truth.
That wrinkle I don't know about.
Well, look, Ken Buesler is out there saying he's going to tell us whether the oceans are safe or not safe, right? He went through lots of efforts to tell us the Pacific Ocean doesn't have that many trace elements of radioactivity in it. Paid a lot of money, got a lot of, big notices over that one. This is the reality. The trace elements that they're testing for, the cesium one, first off, the whole manipulation is about having us forget that we were carpet bombed with nuclear energy, with nuclear bombs after World War II. We have decimated the Pacific Ocean with nuclear pollution since they started the 50s, 60s. He is a tool. I mean, I'm not saying it's his. He is intentionally doing this, but he, like many of the other quote scientists, have been paid to not look at and not ask the real questions. So, for example, one of his big studies in the last year or two was he came out with a scientist up in Canada said the Pacific Ocean has very low levels of, Fukushima trace elements, so you don't have to worry about it. You can eat the fish. In fact, a scientific study came out just yesterday or the day before from Alaska telling us that the fish in the Pacific Ocean has practically no levels of radiation at all from Fukushima, so don't worry about it. The fish is fine. The deal is this. Ken Buesler only tested the water, and they only tested for cesium-134, which goes away after 2 years. Its half-life dissipates in 2 years. We're 6 years in, so every 2 years it keeps dissipating, right? So there is trace, that level of that, but they do not test for cesium-137. They don't test for americium. They do not test for plutonium. They do not test for the hundreds of other radioactive nuclides that are extremely toxic. And the trace elements, so plutonium has a huge half-life. Some of these things have long, hundreds of thousands of years of half-lives, 50,000, 30,000, each one of them. The nuclear industry, they do not allow any of that testing to be done. And the reason they say that it can't be done is because we carpet bombed the whole entire planet with these nuclides after World War II. They can't tell whether it came from Fukushima, or they can't tell whether it came from World War II.
Well, that's the thing about the cesium-132, though, is that because the short life is so small, they know that it absolutely came from Fukushima.
Yes.
So there was some good that came out of the work that I read about.
Okay, but check this out, John. This is the sad part about it.
Yeah.
Saying that it's not in the ocean denies the fact that fish – excuse me, let me fix my microphone so it's not too loud.
Yep.
Fish in the ocean when a fish is swimming in the ocean, it needs potassium. The ocean has very low levels of potassium. So a fish has evolved to magnetize the potassium 1,000 times so it gets enough potassium in its body to live and thrive. It
Correct.
Identifies cesium-134, 137 as potassium, so it magnetizes even trace tiny elements 1,000 times.
Right, they're soaking it up.
Yeah. Right. Not only soaking it up, but making it way bigger. So a fish is actually, Dr. John Goffman talked about this, it's much more toxic to eat a fish out of the ocean that's been contaminated than to drink a gallon of water. So there's a lot of denial about, it's that circular, it's a lack of scientific dishonesty when it really gets down to it on the mandates that the IAEA requires. Like, scientists are not allowed to test for other levels of contaminants, of nuclear radioactive contaminants. For example, do you know that 100% of the tuna tested positive for radioactivity. They have stopped testing tuna, and they've just decided we're going to sell it anyways, right? So do I think that Ken Buesler is intentionally lying to the public? No. I think he has been brainwashed like most doctors, most scientists. The IAEA controls the scientific community in regards to nuclear testing and nuclear information that's allowed to be out there. So I find it challenging to accept Ken Buesler as a respected scientist, because he knows that he is ignoring some facts, and he can't put that in, and he can't talk about it, because if he talks about it, his funding gets cut off.
Right, funding gets cut off. You don't get published.
Do you know who Arne Gunderson is? Do you know Arne Gunderson?
The name is familiar, but I don't.
He's with Fair Winds. He was an engineer at nuclear facilities for many years. After Fukushima, he had been warning the industry that bad things could happen. He was working there and following and clicking his heels and saying Sig Heil, doing what he was told. Then Fukushima happened, and he couldn't stay silent anymore. His funding got cut off. He's basically somewhat ridiculed within the scientific community. That is, and Helen Caldicott, again, another person who has been a loud advocate for the end of all things nuclear, is basically disrespected. I had a nuclear physicist tell me that John Goffman's work has been debunked. No, it hasn't been debunked. What it has been is been disrespected and discredited, but his work stands on its own. In fact, this last week I did an interview with Dr. Chris Busby, and we were talking about, he didn't agree with a lot of what John Goffman was talking about, but he said that his recent studies within the last 5 years, I think he said, shows that the basis of all the safe levels of testing were based on false information and basically corrupted information. The information where we base our levels of safe radioactive contamination is based on a level of corrupted information that was intentionally put into the studies as the core and the heart of the work, to the point where he was able to prove this in a court of law in England and win cases for nuclear victims. And he is proposing that people who live in Europe start invoking what's called the suicide clause, which means if the basis of your information is incorrect, then you have to throw out all the information and start over again. He's hoping that they can stop nuclear in Europe based on this. We don't have the same laws here, but they do have a window of opportunity there. So,
yeah.
And to go back to what this show originally came about because of Fukushima, and as I've unpeeled the onion, the core, the hardcore core of it all is really to expose the fundamental lies. And it's actually grown beyond just the nuclear industry. As John Goffman said, it's the technology. The whole idea of technology for profit fundamentally undercuts the core of scientific knowledge and basis. So we've had lots, like the lead in our water, we have nitrates in our water, we have tritium in our water. We are poisoning our environment at such a catastrophic rate. And our governments are saying, well, we're perfectly fine. It's not that bad. Our tests show that the water is not that bad. That, you know, you guys are just being fear-mongerers as the cancer rates for children go up. So,
well, yeah, these are the same people who firstly established the ludicrous concept of minimum amount of toxins or radioactivity that it's safe to consume. That's crazy to start with. But then there are also the people who raise those levels when the background becomes higher than what they establish as being safe. One of the things that I read about recently is that they at least in Japan, they raised the minimum acceptable level, or the maximum acceptable level, I guess is the proper term, by 300%.
Well, because John, I hate to shock you, but President Obama raised the levels here in the United States exponentially. That right after the United States is more egregious on that one. Right after.
Well, we have more plants than anybody else.
After Fukushima, Hillary Clinton told the Prime Minister of Japan that we won't test our food for radioactive contamination. We import food from Fukushima Prefecture ourselves. Mm-hmm. And Obama, the rates of when they would warn us about radio, well, we've done actually, well, Obama did something, and recently the EPA did something. So Obama, in I think it was 2014, signed an order that said, we used to warn people when people would get cancer, when you were exposed to radioactive contamination, if one person in 10,000 got cancer, we would tell people you're being exposed to higher levels than acceptable levels.
Right.
Now it's 1 in 26.
Right, because so otherwise it would create noise that people wouldn't be able to hear.
You do the math. They're basically going to tell us that we're being exposed. Now, also, the EPA just raised the radioactive limits. If there's an emergency, like let's say you live near a nuclear power plant and there's a meltdown, the rates automatically, all the different nuclides will be raised. Like iodine-131 will be raised by 83,000%. So they're going to raise the levels of radioactivity acceptable levels until the nuclear meltdown stops. Then they'll drop them back down and say, okay, now we can bring the levels back down to a non-emergency level. Instead of telling people they have to leave, they're just going to say, oh, well, let's just raise the rates of contamination. And unless it gets really bad, you know, like the, I mean, how high does it have to be if you're exposed to iodine-131 at a higher level of 83,000% higher than it is right now? I mean, 83,000% when you do that, you add two zeros to that, right? That's 8 million times higher. So it's unconscionable what the nuclear industry is doing to us. And to me, they are the, but the reason we have it, let's be very clear, it's part of the people who think that the Trump nation is going to keep us out of war are sadly mistaken. The whole nuclear industry is geared up to bring us to a nuclear war, period. And it's coming. And that is where I see us going. This is why I love this conversation about shamanism, because I really believe that our thoughts are things that if enough people really believe in peace and harmony and really focus on that, we can change our harmonic energies, can change their minds. They may not have the right thoughts in their heads. They may not be moving from the right place. But if we truly believe it and we focus on it, we can change the energy so that it'll prevent it from really destroying our planet.
Absolutely. And keeping that thought in mind, the only really effective way to try to influence things is in a positive way. To punish the bad guy or wish the bad guy ill is just feeding into the negative dark side of things spiritual. By praying and working toward enlightenment and people recognizing where they have made mistakes and seeking the assistance of spirit to turn them around and change their behavior is working in the side of light and positive energy. Now, a lot of people might think that sounds a little frou-frou and that's not really going to get anywhere. But that's it really will. I started out a real skeptic. I had interest in shamanism for a very long time. But when I began to take it to a new level by formalizing my education in shamanism, there were things I was very skeptical about. And Michael Harner, the founder of the Foundation for Shamanic Studies, himself told me, "That's good," he said. Those guys, the skeptics, make the best shamans because they are the ones to whom it will be revealed that yes, this does work. And they're not just, you know, taking a hook, line, and sinker. They are people whose doubts have been alleviated by evidence that it does work. And I'm one of those people. I'm still skeptical about a lot of things. It's my nature. But when I engage in shamanic work, I have a complete shift. Because it's been demonstrated to me in many cases that, you know, spirits are real. There is something beyond us that can teach us, that can assist us to alleviate suffering and to find solutions to problems. Now, there was a time the skeptic in me would have said, well, maybe I'm, you know, just accessing deeper parts of myself, where, you know, that 9/10 of the brain that Einstein said we didn't use. But it's been demonstrated to me that things go well beyond that. I had a, I'll give you a quick little story if you don't mind. I had a client many years ago, psychotherapist, who had a borderline personality patient. She was very uncomfortable working with this guy. And what happened is she began to have nightmares where he was in these nightmares. So she approached me and asked if there was anything that we could do. So, you know, we did a drumming. And one of my spirit helpers in the form of a plant gave me specific instructions of what I should tell her to do. So without going into too many details, I gave her some instructions of what to do. And over the course of the next 3 days, her dreams should stop. Well, on the third day, this patient of hers comes in, and he has one of those plants in a little pot that he gave to her. And he said that he has decided he's going to take a break from counseling for a while. Not only did the dream stop, but this guy, you know, left the practice. And the fact that he brought, you know, this plant into her as a parting gift for her office was enough to raise the hair on my own neck. You know, I was hoping that, you know, that everything was going to work out fine and the dreams would stop. I had no idea that I was going to get an affirmation like that. These types of stories happen to lots of people a lot of the time. And, you know, go ahead and try to explain it some other way. Perhaps somebody might be able to come up with a plausible explanation. But it was enough for me to recognize that not only is this stuff real, but it feels really good to me to be able to move, you know, to live in this world, you know, to really kind of bridge the you know, the two existences. And now that I'm older, you know, stepping away from a professional life, I think it was Gandhi who said that's the time that you give yourself over to spiritual things. You know, after you've worked, you've raised a family, you've contributed to society, if you feel drawn to spiritual things, that's the proper time to do it in your life when you get older. So that's why I'm you know, really redoubling my my attention to this this sort of work now. You know, I see amazing things happen all the time.
Well, so John, that really, you know, makes me think. I used to pray that Dick Cheney would have a heart attack, and then I realized he didn't have a heart, so I started praying he'd have a brain aneurysm, right? So maybe what I should do is start doing some chanting and not like have a focused end result. Maybe we could change his mind to not be such a complete evil human being, him and Kissinger. Maybe that we could stop the, you know, the complete decimation of the planet if we would actually do some chanting, huh?
You know, it can't hurt. And, you know, if you can wish truly in your heart, wish your enemy happiness, that is, and if that works, your enemy is going to change, you know?
Okay. Well, I'm going to take your advice, Crow. I mean, for real, that is something that I will definitely focus on, because honestly, this whole thing about, I actually do wish Donald Trump well, because I think that he is under an attack that he doesn't even realize is real. And I do wish that he does not succumb to them, because what I foresee if that happens is grave. So I think we're at a precipice where this, in fact, I even take this attitude about the radioactive contamination and the pollution. Somewhere, mm-hmm. may call me the eternal optimist, but I believe if we really focus our thoughts and intentions on creating solutions, like I internally, and I've said this many times on the radio, I believe that sound healing is going to be the solution to reversing the nuclear contamination. I don't know why. I don't understand all of it, but at a gut level, I think that sound, because at sound can change molecules, and that's what we're talking at a molecular structure, mm-hmm. the whole thing. So I think that there has to be some solution. I'm not a death and doomer like Guy McPherson, who says that we've got 10 years on the planet. It's inevitable. Mankind has destroyed the environment to the point where we are just going to start dropping off like flies, period, no matter what. We can have all these good intentions, good thoughts, but we are so far gone that the entire structure of humanity and life as we know it is going to be decimated. I can't abide by that. I don't believe that that is a reality.
Right. Now, the Maya had their long count that ended in 2012, and a lot of people were preparing for the end of the end of life as we know it. But people who are from that culture say no, that was the end of the long count. There is a great change, and then another count begins. There are short counts and long counts in their procedure of timekeeping. And
2012, you said 12.
It was variously interpreted by different archaeologists to be 2011 or 2012.
My God, and then we had Fukushima happen in 2011.
Well, great changes are afoot, and there's no doubt about it. And to say that we're not going to be around in 10 years, that's a pretty specific prophecy or forecast. You'd have to give me more details for me to buy into that, but I'm experiencing, and I'm seeing people all around me experiencing the awareness of really great change. Now, granted, humanity has stood in that awareness, several times in its history, but this is the world that we're living in. This is what I'm seeing, and I believe that we are, at the foot of great change. I don't know what that means. I don't know if it's going to be an Armageddon or if it's going to be a rapture, to use borrowed religious terms. But something is about to happen. We are going to witness it. And I know which side I want to stand on. I want to stand on the side of light. Because as we know, there's a lot of dark forces collecting and concentrating together in governments, not just here in the United States, but France is facing a very similar threat politically, with neoconservative is the nicest way I could describe it.
Yeah, neoliberal policies. That's really what it is. Neoliberal policies.
Yes. Yeah, and I for one don't think that the opposite is always what something needs. I'm a real believer in the middle way. I think it's important for I'm glad to call you a friend as a liberal who is a voice in the wilderness trying to raise people's consciousness, and I think that that's great because we need that. There are also things that the conservatives give us that have value. They don't come to mind right now, but from time
to
time.
Well, I reject the idea of calling them conservatives. They are not conservatives.
Well, the forces that are collecting now, yeah, I think it's a disservice to the term conservatism to call them that. They're just dark. But it's not a matter of conservative, liberal. Those are ideologies. We're talking about real actions that people are taking, and that's what we have to be taking responsibility for, is our actions, not our words, not the things that we're talking about or promising or saying we believe, but our actions and what we
right.
do.
Right.
And, thank you for putting so much of yourself into the great cause of trying to raise people's awareness, because unfortunately, a lot of people are not hearing. And a lot of them aren't listening, but a lot of them just aren't hearing. And we really need to have people bringing these very important issues to their attention. Otherwise, they're just going to be herded into the corral.
I think it's really important for people who don't agree to talk. I think mm-hmm. civility is like the core of the. This is why they call it civilization, because it's based on civility, right? Like, that's the concept. We don't have to agree with each other on how to manipulate our ways through life. We're little tiny creatures who live at max 100 years. Our time mm-hmm. in terms of the course of history is not even a spark of light. It's brief, beyond brief.
Yes. Yeah.
But we have I believe that the gift of Mother Earth is love. I really believe that's what all of the mammals are. And I read a story yesterday that in Germany they say that the trees communicate and have a great sense of love towards each other. When I was younger, John, I was raised a Catholic in a very brutal home. So when I rejected all of that, I used to pray to trees because I thought when you look at a tree, you can plant a tree in the ground, and no matter where you plant it, it tries so hard to thrive. It makes every effort to thrive. It, no matter what you do to it, it continues to want to grow and reach up. And that was what I thought would be like the right way to, that was how I sort of interpreted my springboard from this basic prison as a kid. You know what I mean? Like, I
Yep,
wanted to be
absolutely.
able to thrive. And so that concept that trees were a higher being than we people who breathe in air, because a tree just stands there, accepts from the universe, and thrives. It doesn't object. It has it, and as we've studied plants and animals, they've discovered that plants do actually communicate. They do talk. They talk in a language in a way that we don't see them. Like one of the things I was fascinated by when I took my terrestrial, we did an ecology of the forest. It was basically a camping class, right? The microbes, to learn that the mushrooms are basically a worldwide computer. All the mushrooms connect to each other, to all of them on the land base. It's like this one big gigantic computer system that talks and figures out what the earth, what the dirt needs to make it a healthy environment. It constantly is working to make it a healthy environment.
You could compare it to an organ and a living, a living organism, Gaia, having these organs that are, are part of the life of our planet.
Yeah, and we are part of that life of the planet. And so this idea that it's all out of our control. I mean, somebody said to me, in fact, my sister's friend said this to me, that it's just me being desperate. You know, I just want to desperately believe that I don't need to believe in Jesus Christ. And that's not it, because fundamentally, you know, I didn't reject that concept. I reject the dogma of it all. I mean, it's like my kids often ask me, you know, when we were little, like, you know, why do you do Christmas? Why do you keep talking? Because you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a lot of, I believe in
Absolutely.
ritual. I think that rituals are good. They're part of our process of being humans. We need rituals because we only have 100 years. So we need to mark things to help us understand who we are in the big picture of it all. That's my
Yeah,
concept.
we got to get you under a drum because I think that you would have an amazing experience.
Yeah, that is something I haven't really done. I did do, you know, that healing, but I did it to heal like physical problems. Like, right, I was having kidney problems, and this lady did this. I don't know. It was kind of like the weird. She called it sound healing, and it was like, she called it bowl. It was bowls. That's what they were, and it was
Sure,
like
yeah.
the mo one of the weirdest healings that I had ever had, but it did work. I mean,
Yeah,
I went to
there are
see her for
several
3 months,
forms
and
of
it worked.
acoustic healing that are coming up now. Some trace their roots way back, and others are fairly new innovations. My sister, who is a licensed acupuncturist, has had a practice for decades. She's started to introduce more and more sound work in her treatments, and I hear it from people all the time. They love her. She is a great healer, and that's the route she was attracted to is acupuncture, but she's using a lot of that acoustic healing in her work, and you see more and more of it. And you're gonna be the type of person that responds very well to it. And I highly encourage you to take the leap. You don't have to sign up for anything. You just have to lay down, follow a couple simple instructions, and have a great experience. Now
Okay,
we
well, you
do.
know what I'll do is I'll follow up after the show and I'll talk to you about that off air.
Yeah, I
Now,
encourage you or anybody else to contact the Foundation for Shamanic Studies. They have a listing of practitioners all over the world, and you can probably find someone fairly near you if you're on the West Coast.
the
They're at
Foundation for Shamanic Studies.
www.shamanism.org, and they are a great place to start. There's three things that happen, in my view, in this shamanic work. One is to relieve suffering, to gain knowledge, and to restore harmony where it lacks. And those are three really important things to do. And whether we're making a difference or not in the world, it's surely a noble pursuit anyway to do those things. And I hope that you get the chance to experience that soon.
Okay. Well, look, John, we have about 5 minutes left. Why don't we mm-hmm. talk about your what you are doing with your website? Why don't you give our listeners the name of your website again?
Okay, it's Shamanic Voyages. It's not case sensitive in the search. ShamanicVoyages.com. It will change to ShamanicVoyages.org as soon as you help me form a 501(c).
Okay.
Right now, what we're doing is we're organizing a travel to Mongolia. This is our upcoming trip to work with Mongolian shamans and to experience the culture of Mongolia. That trip will be in this summer, June 26th to July 9th will be the time in country over there. And we're working with an established group that does this work in Mongolia at the moment. And then in the future, we're hoping to offer trips to other areas as well. Our trip to Mongolia is limited to 13 participants. And we are half the way there, a little over half the way there. And the only requirement is that a person is either a shamanic practitioner or someone who has a deep interest and a working knowledge of shamanism. So even if you don't, you've got 6 months to get that way if you really want to go there. And we're very happy to be able to facilitate this kind of work.
What are you going to do on the journey?
We are going to... aside from being exposed to Mongolia and its culture and the work of the shamans there, we're also going to offer some of our shamanic practices and rituals that we have in our work that they're not familiar with. So in this particular instance, we plan to do a sweat lodge, not a specific type of sweat lodge, but more from the core shamanic perspective where the ritual is there, but the dogma isn't so much.
What does that mean?
Lakotas, for instance, have very specific rituals around their sweat lodge. The Navajo have very specific rituals around their sweat lodge, but they differ a great deal. So with us, the sweat lodges I build, I follow the traditions I've been exposed to, but I don't say that this is the way things have to be done. This is an example of a sweat lodge. What takes place inside is familiar to just about anyone who's been in a sweat lodge, but the chants and so forth are anthropocentric. That's what I'm looking for. Anthropocentric chants. They don't belong to a specific culture. Going into too much detail is counterproductive, but I will be instructing them in what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, and whatever my knowledge is of the various cultures that do things a little differently, I'll share with them what I know, and it kind of gives them exposure to something that they haven't seen before. Wow. And that's our offering to them. As well as we're going to receive offerings, from them as well. And their
hey, John, I need to jump in. I just looked. It's 15 seconds. Yes, okay. We've been with John McKinnon, a crow. That's his shaman name, sharing with us the information about real shamanism. Join his website.
Okay, bye-bye.